Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division III Podcast. I'm Zach Babbo. Today my guest is one of the most well-known names in the Division III world, Salisbury coach Jim Berkman. Berkman's coaching resume is long and illustrious. He's the all-time winningest coach in NCAA history at 412-39, a winning percentage that's better than 90%. He's won 10 national championships in his 25 years at the helm of Salisbury and 17 conference titles. He's produced nearly 200 USILA All-Americans and last year won his third D3 Coach of the Year award. His 2012 Salisbury team bristled with great players, and they went 23-0, eventually beating Cortland 14-10 in the Division III championship. After graduation depleted the ranks, Salisbury stumbled in two early games to Lynchburg and Washington and Lee, but the goals have rebounded since, earning the number 6 spot in the USILA coaches poll and a 10-2 record as they enter a big game tonight against former conference rival Stevenson in Salisbury. I talked with Berkman about last year's title run, the rebuilding effort on this year's team, the aura that is Salisbury, and the miraculous story of the recovery of his heart attack from last year. Before we get into our conversation with Berkman, as always, I just wanted to thank everyone who's been following along with the Division III podcast these past few weeks. Our numbers continue to grow. You can find us every Wednesday on InsideLacrosse.com under podcasts, or at the iTunes store under Inside Lacrosse. Make sure to check out the rest of our family of great podcasts that have started up this year. If you have any thoughts or concerns for this show, feel free to contact me, zbabbo, Z-B-A-B-O, at InsideLacrosse.com, or find me at Twitter, at Zach Babbo, at Z-A-C-H-B-A-B-O, no spaces. Okay, and now let's get to our conversation with Salisbury coach Jim Berkman. All right, Coach Berkman, thank you for joining me today. I guess kind of I'll dive in with you off the bat of, can you give me a sense of kind of where you think your team is in particular at this point in the year? I mean, Salisbury, you know, is traditionally a very successful team. This year you guys had two early losses. You're a top 10 program, maybe instead of a top 3 or so like you normally are this year, but this time of year. But you've been rolling through a lot of good wins, and you still have a lot of, you know, a lot of the schedule ahead of you. I guess, what do you kind of think of this year's team?
Well, you know, we knew that we were going to have a little bit of a challenge on offense, you know, graduating. We graduated every player on offense except Ryan Clark, who was a first-team All-American, and then Ryan Clark went down, you know, in the third game of the season. So we really had nobody back on offense that had any experience really whatsoever. So we basically were playing with an entirely new offense, and not only new offense, we were playing with some new kids into the program. So we knew that was going to be a work in progress. And we were hoping that, you know, defensively, that with our keeper and some other people returning, that we'd be able to hold teams at bay a little bit to allow our offense to develop. And we've gotten better on offense. We're not where we need to be yet, but we definitely have gotten better, and we're starting to score a little bit more, and an emergence of a couple players as they learn to play with each other. We're starting to do some good things out there, but we're not where we need to be yet, but we're a work in progress, and, you know, we hope by, you know, the end of April, we'll be able to put ourselves in a position to be playing our best lacrosse when it comes conference tournament time and hopefully NCAA playoff time.
You talk about, you know, kind of the maturation of the team as they come along in a season. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. This is, I believe, your 25th season at Salisbury. I mean, are there certain things you can try and do in the course of a season to accelerate that maturation, or is it kind of just a natural process of playing a schedule and just kind of figuring yourself out, and you kind of hope the team does it within time to get a couple of W's and, you know, make itself successful for later in the year?
Well, I mean, we've definitely worked a lot more on attack. You know, we actually kind of have a period of practice that's either before practice or after that we call attack development. You know, and it's a lot of basic fundamental drills that, you know, hopefully some kid got down the road before he got here. But, you know, a lot of just basic things that we're getting a lot of reps with box shooting and working on our hands on the inside and, you know, working our catching and shooting and, you know, just little nuances of the game at attack that a lot of college coaches probably never spend any time on. We actually have dictated a period to, whether it was pre or post practice, so that we're getting more reps so those guys stick. We probably shot a lot more in practice, too, you know, as far as a period of that two-hour block being dedicated to shooting. We've always shot a lot here. I think we've shot even more this year. And through those two things, I think that, number one, we're shooting the ball better. We're making a little bit better decisions on the fast break. Our hands are getting better inside, and we're starting to score more inside goals with our crease play with Steven Norris, which is exciting. But also, I think that we're moving the ball a whole lot better on offense. You know, we're starting to move ball faster than teams can slide, which has always been one of our characteristics here to allow us to take advantage of some of the quick sliding teams. So we're definitely seeing some improvement. And as a coach, I think that our coaching staff has done a good job of challenging the offensive guys and asking them to do a little bit more maybe than they normally would on a daily basis to work on those skills. And it's exciting to see that improvement when you see the ball moving a little bit faster, kids making the extra step inside, kids realizing swinging the ball and skipping it to the backside that we didn't get, you know, a month ago that's starting to happen in our offense. But again, that's been a lot of repetitions and a lot of drills that, you know, that maybe we didn't spend as much time in the past and spend it on other things.
You know, a lot was made last year. We're talking about kind of the maturation of this year's team, and a lot was made last year in the really prolific senior class. You guys wind up graduating after winning the national championship and going undefeated, and that storyline kind of came back up with some of those early losses, and people were kind of talking about getting the team, you know, kind of this year's Salisbury squad figuring itself out. You know, I mean, you've been doing this for a while. Is there a certain process to things like this? You know, Salisbury's had a lot of classes that have been very, you know, much heralded classes, All-American, you know, deep classes that were big contributors, and then they wind up graduating. Is this kind of one of those things that's cyclical for you, that every couple of years you really have to almost completely reload on the offensive or defensive end? And are there just ways you approach a season like that, or ways you approach a team like that, because you know there's going to be certain amounts of development that are different than maybe in years where you know you have a senior class that has been doing it for years or something?
Well, I think there's a couple things here that come into play. You know, first of all, I don't think any coach wants to put themselves in a position that, you know, we were. I mean, obviously, I'd like to be able to coach the team I had last year. I mean, you know, you look at there was three guys drafted, you know, one of the best players that may make the U.S. team. Then you got a couple other guys that started playing pro indoor this winter in Lance Carter. I mean, it was just a phenomenal team that, you know, coach dreams of being able to coach someday. But on the same token, you know, as a coach, you know, we usually have the next, you know, there's three or four guys in that mix on offense especially that have gotten, you know, a lot of time and are key players, so that you do have a couple guys to build around the next year. But last year was a very unique year in that, you know, we had four or five fifth-year players because of injury, you know, that also made the senior class even that much bigger. So, you know, like Eric Crum was a fifth-year player because of a knee injury. Dean Rossi was a fifth-year player. You know, Mendez, because of transferring, was a fifth-year player. So it added some few more kids into that class to being bigger than, you know, you never would imagine a class being. You lose everybody. You don't ever want to really do that, but it allows you to play a pretty special year. We usually have a next, you know, usually in a mix like that, you still like, well, the seventh scorer, the fifth scorer, the eighth scorer, the 11th scorer, well, those are guys coming back. But that wasn't the case last year. You know, the leading scorers were all the way through, you know, the 10 or 11 mark, except for Ryan Clark, and then you end up losing Ryan Clark, you know, for the season. Well, maybe not the season now. The word is maybe that if the MRI is all right, then maybe, you know, it would be a pleasant surprise to see Ryan Clark come back, you know, playoff time.
How kind of unique or out of left field almost was that Ryan Clark news earlier this year? I mean, you hear about kids going down with injuries all the time, but, you know, something like an internal, you know, organ injury, a spleen issue, I mean, that seems really, I guess, kind of unique in terms of how rare that shows up on an injury report. I mean, in your many years of coaching, was that one of the more startling off-season losses that you've had?
Well, what was so startling about Ryan, you know, we're in a third quarter of the Widener game, you know, and it's a battle, and Ryan goes down the middle, takes a shot, guy slides on him, kind of just pushes him a little bit, and the guy's behind him. Nobody falls down. It doesn't look like a big hit. There's no penalties. You know, and he kind of limps off, and he doesn't say anything, you know. And then he pursues to play in the fourth quarter. Not as effective. You could tell he was hurt a little bit. But, you know, people just thought he got stunned a little bit because he didn't say anything. And, you know, didn't say anything to the trainers. That, you know, they thought he was all right after the game. And, you know, he wakes up Sunday morning and his shoulders are bothering him and his stomach's bothering him because he's got some internal bleeding going and it's starting to affect the other parts of his body. You know, then they had to rush him to the hospital and you find out it was a grade 4 laceration or whatever, which is pretty high. I mean, I guess people can die from a grade 4 in that regard to the spleen. So it was kind of a freaking bizarre incident because usually we think something of that magnitude, it would have been a big hit. The kid would have went down for a while, you know, but none of that really occurred.
You know, you mentioned some of your players that, you know, that particularly Harold and senior class that just left, how deep it was and, you know, how a lot of those guys have gone off and or they're playing in different pro leagues, the USA team now. They're obviously not the first. You know, you've had other pretty illustrious, you know, alumni that have come through and joined those pro leagues. When those kind of things happen, when kids leave your program and they end up in those leagues, is there any kind of a validation or pride in the program for that? In that, you know, typically D1 is always looked at as you know, a certain level of athleticism or skill above D3. And so for you as a D3 program to generate players that can play in those leagues, you know, with or better than a lot of the D1 crew that maybe doesn't advance that far. I mean, is there something there in terms of showing that, you know, we create a product here that can stand on a lot of levels?
Well, I think, Zach, that as a coach, you know, you take it's a great sense of pride when you see a kid improve and develop over time. And, you know, we've been fortunate that that's been one of the things here, that kids have gotten a lot better because of the culture and the work ethic and really improved. And to see a kid, you know, attain that because he worked so hard and really, really improve, you know, to the point that, you know, you have a lot of Division I people saying, man, how we missed, there's another guy we missed. You know, like Eric Martin, who started on the world team last time, you know, still playing pro indoor and outdoor. The kid was a monster when he was a senior. And then Kyle Hart, so I mean, the list goes on and on of guys that have come through here that are still, you know, playing at a pretty high level. As a coach, it's just a great sense of pride because, you know, I remember those guys when they first got here, and I remember where they were at, but so proud of where they finished. And, you know, I think the program and the culture here, you know, had a lot to do with their development and motivation to attain such a high level of play that, you know, that's definitely very gratifying as a coach.
You know, I guess that kind of leads into, I mean, part of what tends to build a program that's as consistently successful as yours is the day-to-day operations kind of stuff, the practice culture, you know, all those kind of secrets, I guess you could call them almost. Can you take me through or kind of describe to me a little bit of what a Salisbury practice might be and how it cultivates that environment? I mean, I've heard a little bit from people about the size and scale and levels of intensity of a Salisbury practice. I've seen some clips of some of the drills and whatnot you've done that seem very effective, at times innovative. I mean, maybe we'll get into the tactical drill stuff later, but just, you know, is there a certain kind of energy or competition or scale of practice you're trying to keep to build that kind of culture?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that go into that, Zach, but, you know, I think first of all, we got to clarify that, you know, I'd be a fool, and I think anybody would be a fool to think that, you know, we're doing anything different from 3 to 5, you know, that anybody else is doing. You know, if we think that we're a whole lot smarter than Coach Canopy and Stevenson from 3 to 5, or if we think we're a lot smarter than, you know, the Washington College guys from 3 to 5, or we're working that much harder, that would be a fool's goal, you know. I think, you know, there's just a lot of good coaches. I mean, there's a lot of great Division III coaches, you know, with a lot of great players. You know, I think the thing that we've always been able to do, and I think some of the other teams are catching up now in that regard, is that, you know, we've had what we call the edge workouts here. And the edge workouts are the workouts outside of 3 to 5. You know, and I think for a long time, and I think other people are closing the gap here a little bit now, is that, you know, we had a lot more guys that were doing the lifting and were doing the running throughout the season and the year, that were doing the wall ball, were going out and doing extra shooting. You know, here it's the majority, not the minority, if you know what I mean, on a consistent basis. So we had more kids, you know, developing the shooting, developing the stick skills. I mean, you look at last year's team, I don't know how many people said, man, coach, your guys are so much bigger than everybody else. There was a lot of guys in that senior class last year that were really into lifting, who were dedicated, that, you know, had put 20 pounds of muscle on and gotten faster, you know, over their four-year period here. So they look bigger than a lot of Division I teams. But it's been that culture, I think, outside of the normal practice, number one, that a lot of guys have gotten better because they just, you know, Sam Bradman. You know, why is Sam Bradman shoot so well? Well, you know, Sam's always shooting. You know, Canone's always shooting. You know, and even now, because they're kind of helping us out, you know, last night, who are the two guys staying on the field to supervise the players when practice is over? You know, it's Bradman and Canone out there shooting with 12 or 14 guys for another 45 minutes to an hour, you know, working on their shot. You know, how many teams have that many guys staying after on a regular basis or coming out early or doing it during the day? Again, I think that's been the majority here and not the minority like a lot of players. So, you know, the skill level gets a little bit better. I think that's always kind of been a thing. But I think, you know, more and more kids are doing more and more of that. More and more coaches are setting up environments and cultures that really encourage it. So that gap is getting closed a little bit. Practice-wise, I think we practice awful hard. You know, not that we're doing anything different, but, you know, in practice here, we're getting after each other. We're not, like, walking through stuff. You know, we're taking 5 seconds to get to the next drill, and then it's all out. You know, we beat on each other a lot in practice. It's competitive every day. So I don't know if that's a lot of different, but some, you know, I've had Division I coaches come and watch us practice, and they're just amazed at, number one, of how fast and how fast we practice, how little downtime there is, and how competitive practice is. So I don't know if that's just kind of my philosophy and what we've kind of ingrained in them. Hey, when you come out today, you're competing. You know, I think back of last year, you know, on a daily basis, Sam Bradman had a personal competition with Alex Taylor in practice. You know, that he was going to score some goals on AT today, and AT, you know, had a personal vendetta. Bradman, I don't care how good you are, you're not getting nothing today. You know, so, you know, when you play that hard, it simulates the game, like, conditions that you're going to have, or sometimes, you know, practices are harder than games. You know, so we practice hard, and that even goes the day before a game. You know, I'm a big believer in that you don't want to leave your game in practice, so the day before a game, you know, we never decrease the intensity, we just decrease the duration, because we never want to play at a slower speed than we're going to play in the game. So, you know, like yesterday's pregame practice, you know, we were like 50 minutes yesterday, but you know what? We were playing pretty hard for 50 minutes. People come and get, holy cow, this is a pregame practice? You know, but it was a relief that we weren't out there for 2 hours or 2 hours and 15 minutes and the kids' legs are staying fresh. But, you know, they played at the same pace that they're going to need to play, you know, tonight when we play at Stevenson.
I guess that's a perfect segue to kind of talk about, you know, the upcoming game tonight. I mean, this is obviously a pretty big game on both of your team's schedules here. Maybe a little different dynamic this year because you guys aren't conference rivals, and it seems, I guess, most years, you know, Salisbury is the team higher in the rankings, and Stevenson is trying to maybe get that chip of respect or kind of that big win. Maybe this year that's a little reverse. I mean, how are you guys maybe approaching tonight's game against Stevenson?
Well, we're not approaching tonight's game any different than we have any other game this year. You know, we've had a lot of prep, got a great scout report. You know, worked on their man-up plays. We got our good matchups, hopefully, the guys we're going to guard. We got some couple new little wrinkles to put in on offense that hopefully will, you know, negate some of the things that they do on defense. We got a couple new little wrinkles on man-up that, you know, they haven't seen so that, you know, hopefully we can generate some things relative to what we see as a couple of their weaknesses. But, you know, in the minds of everybody, you know, on the team, this is always, it's a big game. It's a fun game to play in. You know, there's tendencies, if you look back over the last probably 6 or 7 years, you know, the largest crowd each team has had during that season has always been this game. You know, the players really get up for it. I mean, it's just, it's all out war for 60 minutes, basically.
Can you talk a little about that, the kind of the growth of that rivalry? I mean, I've gotten to see a handful of those games. They're great games. If you look at maybe the past 5 or so years of that rivalry, the stats and the results are pretty kind of startling, almost in the evenness and how close the records are, how it always seems to be, you know, no team ever wins 2 in a row, it seems. You always, if you win one, you lose the next. I think the overall goals in the series is, you know, is within 5 or 10 between the two teams. I mean, really, it's one of those thin margin kind of things. The teams match up well against each other. They play hard against each other. You talked about the crowd. You know, I've been on the sidelines for that game, and there's an energy there in the game. There's a real, real heated rivalry kind of aspect to it where both of those teams, you know, you can definitely tell that both of those programs, they really want that win over the other guy in a given year. I mean, how have you kind of seen that grown?
Well, it's gotten magnified very quickly for a couple reasons. I mean, obviously, you know, a rivalry takes a while to manifest itself, you know, because you play for, you know, well, we played Washington College, you know, since the first year of the program, so obviously that's a big rivalry. But, you know, the last few years, you know, we've played 3 times a year, you know, which is like 3 years. And when you play 3 times or 2 times a year for the last 5 or 6 years, it almost makes the rivalry seem longer than it is, and it magnifies it a lot quicker. You know, then both teams have you know, been top programs the last couple years, and so the battles have been against the very best teams in the South, vying to try to get into that slot as the championship, you know, representative. I mean, you know, I don't know if you ever played hockey, you know, or played in a 7-game series of any sort. When you play in a series, man, it's just amazing how the rivalry and the intensity magnifies each game as you move through that series. So, you know, that part of the equation, I think, has really magnified, you know, the rivalry too. You know, and obviously, you know, they're an up-and-coming program, and, you know, they want to be on par with us. They want to do, Coach Canopy wants to do what Salisbury's, you know, done. He wants to play in a championship. He wants to win in the championship. And so that, you know, and they kind of know that for a while it's had to go through us to get there. So, you know, that's magnified the rivalry, you know, a little bit, you know, also.
I guess, does the game have a different feel or approach potentially this year by virtue of the fact that, you know, it's not a conference game, that the likelihood of having one of those, you know, scenarios where you'll play 2 to 3 times in 2 weeks, you know, isn't going to happen because you guys won't see them again in the CAC tournament later? You know, I mean, obviously it's still a huge non-conference game, but it's, this one isn't going to necessarily affect who's the 1 seed or the 2 seed in the CAC conference this year.
Oh, but this game could really affect who's going to be the 1, 2, 3, 4, or who's going to get a better seed, or, you know, down the road for the playoffs. You know, for us, it's a big game in that regard because, you know, we did get bumped by 2 goals early in the season. You know, a win tonight would definitely be a big feather in our cap as far as our strength of schedule goes. You know, they've had a lot of kind of nice out-of-conference wins, but, you know, some of those out-of-conference wins are against teams that, in the end, probably aren't going to count a lot because, you know, they're, you know, the RIT wins a North win, so it's not, you know, in-region win, and the Nazareth win. So, you know, this is a big game as far as hosting playoff games, what seeds you're going to get, being able to play on home field maybe a little bit more down the road than having to go play on somebody else's field. So there's definitely a lot at stake tonight.
Is this a rivalry, I guess, that, you know, when I talked to Coach Canabine a while ago, he sounded like he, you know, he really likes this game, and even though it's not a conference game, you know, he's going to look to keep it going. I mean, are you guys kind of the same way, that it's a game that you both kind of see a value to, and that even without the conference kind of natural scheduling anymore, you'll make a point to try and keep this a non-conference game from year to year?
Yeah, I wouldn't see any reason why we wouldn't do that other than, you know, as Coach Canopy and I have discussed a couple of the things that have transpired that can't transpire in future contests. We'd be glad to play the game as long as we can.
Now, you talk about, you know, the seeding issues and how that affects, you know, stuff like playing a home game in the playoffs and the like. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what maybe the home environment is like for a Salisbury game? I mean, obviously, with the success of the program, you guys have a pretty healthy following. I've heard Seagull Stadium's a good place to come see a game. You mentioned some of the size of crowds for contests like Stevenson or when you guys are in the playoffs. I mean, what's it like to have an environment like that that gets pretty, you know, passionate and pretty populated by fans?
Well, you know, we've created a pretty unique environment here over 25 years of success that on a big game day, it's a pretty special place to play. And game day starts here for the players. You know, they gather outside the locker room in our gym, which is on one side of campus, you know, and then they walk out through the tunnel under the road. And, you know, the tunnel's pretty well documented on YouTube and everything else. And they have a special chant they sing before the games that they've been doing since a guy who was in the Marines, Andrew Harris, who developed the Seagull song. And as they chant coming out of the tunnel, you know, there's all the parents and a lot of alumni as they walk up out of the tunnel as they make their way, you know, over to the field. And that's a pretty special, you know, ritual that takes place that kind of, you know, sets the tone that, hey, it's time to go to war, it's time to go to battle, and, you know, we're going to play in Seagull Stadium and take a lot of pride in doing that. So that's kind of how game day starts. But, you know, the other thing that's kind of unique about Salisbury versus a lot of schools is that, you know, we are the only thing in Salisbury. You know, it's not like being in Baltimore and, you know, there's Loyola and there's Stevenson and there's Hopkins and there's UMBC and, you know, Gouch. I mean, you go on any given day, there's, you know, 8-9 games going on. You know, Salisbury tonight, you know, because it's a big game, it won't be just about going to the game. It'll be about, like, hey, I'm going to an event. You know, there's people going to come to the game tonight just because they want to be seen in the community, not that they came about lacrosse. So you're going to have the business crowd. You're going to have the people that come from my church. You're going to have there's a retired senior citizen group that comes to all the games. And then you're going to obviously going to have all the students, you know, that are going to be there too. So the community is really behind it. You're going to have a lot of little guys that we've done clinics with that are going to be there. You're going to have local high schools because that's the place to be tonight. So that's pretty special, you know, to be able to play in that environment. And then, even though our stadium, and we're in the process of building a stadium here in the next year or two, it's going to be, you know, it's going to rival some of the best stadiums in Division III. Our stadium doesn't have big stands, but you know what? The stands are right on top of the field. So when those 2,000 people are packed in behind the bench, you can't hear a word on the field. It's a pretty intense environment. And then the fence on the far side, right along the field, and there's a lot of Seagull hecklers that can get under some people's skin on that far side of the field. That makes it a pretty tough environment, you know, to kind of play in, but a pretty passionate environment to want to play in.
You know, the home environment sounds kind of formidable enough with, you know, with the intense crowd right on top of you, the whole walking out through the tunnel. I've seen those YouTube videos before. I mean, there's definitely a presence to that. But even on the road sometimes, I mean, to see kind of the typical, you know, two columns of Salisbury and gold, you know, marching at you. I mean, at times there seems to be a certain intimidation factor. Obviously, part of that, too, is you know, with a program as successful as yours, there's got to be a certain thing where when you're on the other side of the field looking at Salisbury, you kind of know what you're up against. I mean, you know, being at the helm of a team like that for so long, have you seen or become aware sometimes of the way that can almost influence games, the way other teams can look at you guys and just kind of know what they're dealing with is a handful that maybe, I mean, I feel like I've seen it in the course of games where if a team might have a lead on you guys, if you guys pour it on in the third quarter or something and come back, you can almost kind of look at the other team as like they kind of knew this was coming anyway because, hey, we're playing Salisbury and they're, you know, it's just this is what they do. I mean, all that success over years is almost start to have a psychological edge to it, I got to think.
Well, I think there's a little edge there too, but I also think it gives your players a sense of confidence. You know, I liken it to a lot like when, you know, I first coached in here and Hobart was kind of on their run and, you know, there was the aura of Hobart and, you know, I think that a lot of teams, you know, that you go to play Hobart at Hobart, it was almost like, you know, that aura was worth two or three goals. You know, so even if you had a very competitive team, you know, you were kind of, you had to not only beat them, but you had to overcome the three-goal aura that kind of went with it, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, we talk about that a lot, you know, the pride of playing at Seagull Stadium, jumping on them early, not letting them get any confidence, you know, they're going to be overly excited, going to make some mistakes, let's take advantage of those. You know, that is what it is, and if it's an advantage, man, we're definitely gonna accept it in any way.
You know, I guess kind of riffing on that idea a little bit. I mean, you talk about the aura of Hobart. You know, I've heard kind of similar sentiments about Salisbury. I've also heard you guys, you know, referred to as almost like the Yankees of D3 and how consistently successful you are and how talented the teams seem to be. And obviously with the Yankees, people call them, you know, evil empire stuff in baseball. At times, you know, there's almost that kind of, you know, it's Salisbury so good every year. There's that kind of a look on them. I mean, is that one of those things you almost kind of, you get used to embracing being so good, so successful every year, the kind of the almost envy or the way that sometimes that produces people that just, you know, they want to root against the program a little bit just because, you know, Salisbury's good again, I want to see somebody else maybe. I mean, that seems to kind of be one of those things that's just part and parcel to being good, that everybody, when you get to be good for a certain amount of time, people start to almost, you know, be like, dang, they're good again, I guess, almost.
Well, you know, but I think that kind of happens in anything. You know, I think Duke and basketball has a similar, you know, you got the people that are passionate about Duke, but you got a lot of people that hate Duke. You know, just because Coach Krzyzewski is such a good coach, they continually have a great program, you know. And I think that kind of happens almost in any sport. You know, it's just our society, you know. Hey, the guy lives in a bigger house across the street, he drives a better car, you know, he's not a good guy. Well, I mean, he might be the greatest guy in the world, but, you know, because he has a better car, a bigger house, you know, they're evil or, you know, or did something wrong. But, I think sometimes, you know, people see that just because we've had so much success and enjoyed it that they kind of simulate us to being like the Yankees and buying our success like, you know, we don't buy our success like the Yankees does with our payroll, believe me. But, you know, I've definitely, you know, sensed that. It hurts me sometimes when people call us, you know, or say that we're the evil empire. You know, just a bunch of people working real hard, trying to be the best lacrosse players and the best people we can be. And, you know, we've been fortunate to win a lot more games than we've lost. And, you know, hopefully we can continue to do that by working hard and doing all the right things.
You know, you obviously, you kind of make the joke. I mean, you're not paying players because, you know, that's not how the college system works. And I mean, I guess what is then, you know, kind of the, I mean, obviously college teams can't go out and buy the best team at a free agency or something like that. So what is the success, the key almost for you guys of being able to so consistently just cultivate these big groups of talent? And maybe even is that part of it? I mean, in the sense that, you know, you guys keep a pretty big roster and obviously being in a lacrosse rich state like Maryland is going to help, but, you know, you do pull talent from other areas. I mean, how do you consistently keep such a crop of talent coming to Salisbury every year?
Well, I mean, again, I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why it's such a good thing, but again, I think there's also a lot of reasons why people are catching up. You know, for a long time, there was a lot of guys that there wasn't a lot of full-time coaches, you know, and now, like, everybody's a full-time coach. I think it's pretty important if you look at all our sports at the university here at Salisbury, you know, you say, man, every coach has been there for, other than the new basketball coaches, most of the coaches have been here for, you know, 20-plus years. You know, so continuity, I think, it plays a lot to success. You know, you have the coach in place, doing the right things, working hard, you know, has got a program, he's got a set of drills he believes in and a system he believes in, you know, that goes a long way, you know, to start to having a successful program. And now, you know, but now almost everybody's got full-time coach. But not only that, you know, and we need to catch up a little bit with some of the other people now, is that, you know, so many people that we're competing against, you know, and tonight's another case of it, you know, they have full-time assistant coach. You know, in Division III, that used to be unheard of, where now you look at a lot of top schools, that's the norm instead of the exception. So there's a lot more emphasis going into the program. There's a lot more, obviously, with two full-time people, a lot more recruiting being done. But for us, you know, we've always had a pretty good product here, and with the growth of the university and all the new facilities that we have, you know, we have a pretty impressive physical plan of our university. When you come on campus, there's a wow factor now here with all the new buildings, and we're ready to break ground on a new $110 million library and student center. Next year, we're breaking ground on a $12 million stadium. You know, it's an impressive place, and then, you know, and then now we're the academic part of the equation is just going off the charts here. You know, we're rated very, very competitive in the Barron's book, and the students just get better and better. 9,500 applications last year for 1,200 spots. So academically, we're a very strong choice also. And then, you know, obviously the cost, you know, in-state we're like $16,000, and even out-of-state we're still maybe just a hair under $25,000, so we're a pretty good deal financially. And then, you know, you top it off, that you come here, you might be able to play some pretty good lacrosse. It's a pretty good package.
How much do you think, you know, in some ways that allows you to build a program like this, the idea of, you know, I mean, we touched on it a minute ago, the idea of the regionality in that you're in Maryland already, the way you pointed out, you know, Salisbury is kind of being where it is and that it's the only event in town, it really draws that magnified focus to the program. And also that, you know, being a state school, the benefits of things like tuition and resources and things, I mean, it seems like kind of that all helps feed into a real environment that can help kind of foster all these things, you know, to grow a little quicker maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, we definitely have the resources here to be successful. You know, it wouldn't matter if it was Jim Berkman, it was John Doe. If John Doe was a pretty smart guy, and you know, he could figure out that, you know, you could be pretty good in lacrosse if you work hard and you do the right things and you coach the right way here. Because all our sports are very successful here. But, you know, we definitely have some, you know, perks, and, you know, it doesn't hurt when you walk in after seeing the whole university and you walk into my office and there's 10 championship posters and rings on the wall, and guy says, whoa, school's here, business school is awesome, nationally accredited, can play great lacrosse, have a chance to be a champion. It's a pretty good product, you know, that we have to sell. And a chance to be an All-American, you know, because we've had 172 of them in the last 24 years, which is, you know, a lot of All-Americans relative to a lot of other teams.
You know, you guys tend to run into Cortland a lot in the championship game, and I guess some of the stuff I'm pointing out with the state school and the kind of regionality in a lacrosse-rich area, Cortland kind of enjoys some of those same things, being tucked away up there in upstate New York in a very lacrosse-rich area. In any way, I mean, is maybe part of the reason why you guys see each other so often, do you maybe see any parallels between you guys in terms of the setup of the school, the growth of the programs, or just something as basic as, yeah, we're both pretty good because we both tend to run into each other a lot in the playoffs?
Well, I mean, there's some similarities. You know, they're much more of a, when you look at our rosters over the years, you wouldn't say, oh, God, that's the State University of Maryland. You know what I mean? You know, last year, you know, one attackman's from Long Island, one attackman's from North Carolina, and one attackman's from California. The best player in you know, might be the best player in the world this year, Sam Bradman, is from New York. You know, but when you look at Cortland's roster, you know, it's a New York team with maybe one or two kids out of state sprinkled in. So our team's more of a national team. And when you look at this year, you know, we got a starting defenseman from California. You know, defense Nick Smitty from New Jersey. You know, we do have some Maryland kids, but it isn't all Maryland kids. Academically, you know, we can attract kids from all over the country, and we've had to do that because, you know, a lot of the best players in Maryland from those private schools, you know, they're going to Division I. So we have to search, you know, beyond our state boundaries to get the quality of players that, you know, allow us to be competitive on a national level. So, you know, they do have a little bit more state identification with their team as far as where their group of players come than we do, where we have a little bit more of a national. You know, one of our starting D-middies is a freshman. He played at Lake Highland, won the state championship 2 years ago in Florida for one of my former players. I mean, he's a great freshman D-middy, but, you know, he's from Florida. So we have kids from everywhere. I think that's a little bit different than Cortland. Plus, I think, you know, academically, you know, the majors at Salisbury that draw kids is a lot different than the majors that draw kids from Cortland. You know, we're more of a business, science-based school. You know, they're more of a physical education, recreation, and then maybe secondary to some of the, you know, the other majors. So it's a little bit different in some regards, but definitely both schools have the ability to, you know, to get and attract, you know, some of the best players in the country.
Is there a rivalry almost slightly? I mean, maybe not to the levels of Stevenson or a program like that that you see consistently in the regular season every year. But, you know, with how often you guys have ended the season, you know, Cortland versus Salisbury, is there, I guess there's an implied familiarity beyond that. Is there a rivalry at all there in terms of just so frequently seeing each other, you know, in the championship game?
You know, I haven't thought that, you know, Cortland as a rival as much as, you know, just thinking of a great program. You know, because when you finally get there and if you have that opportunity, which we did last year and then we did in, 2008 too. I mean, when you get to that last game, you're not thinking about rivalry, you're thinking about winning a championship, you know. you're not really thinking about a rivalry as much. You're thinking about winning the championship at that point and whatever you have to do. They just happen to be the team you're playing on that day.
I remember last year after the D3 championship, I really liked the story we had running on our website that was kind of touching on how, you know, a couple of big coaching moves or tweaks, I guess, in game plan during the course of that game seemed to really seal your 14-10 win against Cortland in last year's championship. You know, I mean, this many months out, I don't know how fresh all that is, but can you think of certain things in that game that were maybe, you know, matchups or just things you saw that you realized if we do this or we do that, you know, it'll lead to success?
Well, you know, not having played them in the season last year and only watching film of them, and we had a lot of film. My assistant coach had, you know, copied all their streamed games. I think we had 19 of their games that we saw before, you know, which is pretty unusual to see that many of your opponent's games because of all the streaming that goes on now and film exchange stuff. We knew Slavik was really good, but we didn't know he was quite that good. And so, you know, early in the game, he stuck one, and then he got another opportunity. And then, you know, then we pulled Sellers from close, you know, up to play him, and then at that point he was kind of, Sellers was able to negate his strengths, and I think that took away, you know, a little bit of their offense at that point. I think that was a big play. And then, you know, we kind of, and that was a big coaching change. I mean, it's not, no brain surgery, you know. Lance Carter got in, had a good shift, you know, then got another good shift, and then he ended up, just because he got on, you know, guy's hot, just like in basketball, you don't take him out. You know, and a kid who hadn't played a lot, you know, more of a second midfielder, kind of stepped up and, you know, had 3 goals and an assist in that game and ran with the first line. You know, a lot of coaches might not have done that, you know, at that point. Hey, he's on the second line. He had a good shift. Wait till his shift comes up, when we kind of just rolled the dice and said, hey, Lance, you're rolling. Let's go, baby. You know, and Lance played a whole lot more in that game than he'd played in any other game the whole season.
Obviously, you know, we can't talk about last year without kind of talking about probably the biggest personal headline in terms of you was the heart attack and then coming back from it. I mean, you know, I the story's kind of been talked about a lot, but I guess it's surprising enough that it kind of warrants that kind of talk. I mean, can you take me through any of it in terms of just what happened? And I know I got to see you talk at the USILA convention where you were, you know, honored with the D3 Coach of the Year. And you were talking about, I was really surprised how you kind of credited a lot of the recovery or just generally, you know, being, you know, your overall health in the incident with your very regimented and stuck to workout routines and your previous competitions and things like triathlons and the like. I mean, can you talk a little about just what that process was and maybe, you know, what you credit coming out okay from it all with?
Well, you know, first of all, you never think it's going to be you. I mean, that's just, I don't care who you are, you never think it's going to, you're not going to be that guy, you know, and having a little bit of some bad genes in my family, you know, a brother that passed away when he was 44, and a dad who passed away was 46, you know, another brother had a major stroke in his 50s, you know, we obviously didn't have a great set of genes to start with, so, but, you know, I've always been one of those guys that I just love to work out of, you know, I'm competitive. Back in 1984, when I moved to New York from going to grad school at Salisbury, you know, I started doing triathlons. I ended up doing over 100 triathlons. You know, ran a marathon in 3:14, did a lot of things and worked out religiously, you know, 6 days a week. And it's probably, you know, like today, you know, we couldn't have this conversation at 12 today because I'm going out on my bike for 20 miles. You know, that's just kind of, you know, what I've always done to be healthy and to stay healthy. And, you know, I've always eaten pretty good. But about 2 weeks before it happened, you know, knee injury a few years ago has relegated me to the treadmill 2 days a week and walk a minute, run a minute, and then ride bikes the other days. But about 2 weeks before, anytime I got my heart rate above 160, I started to get a little bit of burning in my throat. And I didn't know what, and as soon as I got done running the 1 minute harder and started walking, you know, that burn would go away. And I was like, you know, I need to see the trainers. I don't know what's going on. And then finally, we had just played a game the Sunday before WNL last year on Saturday and Sunday morning, 7 a.m. I'm at the gym, you know, and I'm getting ready to get on the treadmill. And I got this burn in my throat already, you know, and I haven't even started working out. And so I get on the treadmill and I start walking for a minute. And I'm like, holy cow, this isn't right. Something's wrong. So I walked in the locker room. And I called my wife, and this is at the local World Gym, at 7 a.m., and said, hey, honey, you know, I'm going to go to the hospital. There's something going on. You know, I just don't know. She was like, no, you need to call, you know, 911. I said, no, I'm all right. And then I hung up the phone, and then while I was sitting there changing my clothes, I had a heart attack. I mean, I literally broke out, you know, the classic case, sweating profusely, no pain in my chest or arm or anything, but just sweating profusely, you know. And when that happens, you know, time just kind of stands still. I don't know if I was sweating for 30 seconds. I don't know if I was sweating for 2 minutes. You know, it's just kind of, you're like in that moment. And then stop sweating profusely and put my clothes on, got in the car and drove to the hospital. And I walked in the hospital in the emergency room and said, you know, I think I just had a heart attack. Well, not that you'd ever want to do that, but when you walk in the emergency room and you tell them you got a heart issue, you get immediate service. and in a minute, you know, next thing I know, I was hooked up to hundreds of electrodes and doctors were everywhere. And even after all that, you know, they did all the tests and the EKG, Dr. Hearn comes in and he says, Jim, you know, I don't know. He says, you know, your EKG is normal again already. You know, I don't know what's happened. We're not sure if you got an inflamed heart or you got an infection in there. And then he started talking to me about my history. And he says, you know what? Let's go in there and take a look. He said, just based on your history. And I said, sure, I think that's a good idea. And at this point, they still didn't know that I had a heart attack because all my vital signs had gone right back to normal because I, you know, was pretty healthy. So I went in, and sure enough, he got in there, and he found a 100% blockage, you know, in one of my major arteries. And if it wasn't for all the other circulatory arteries that had developed from working out for years that were able to keep the blood flowing, you know, I probably would have died. So they put a couple stents in, found a little bit of a dark spot in the bottom of my heart, and, you know, and at that point I went into cardiac rehab and had to take it easy and work my way back into you know, our normal fitness routine, and hopefully with a lot of medication also, I'm back to normal now.
Did you even surprise yourself with the speed of the recovery almost? I mean, I know I was kind of startled when I heard about it in the first place, and then it seemed that, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks afterwards, you were back on the sideline, it seemed, the coaching?
Oh, you know, it's amazing. It's like one of those things, and, you know, thank God for modern medicine. Literally, 5 days after it happened, if somebody would have told me that I had a heart attack and I had 2 stints in, I would have told them they were crazy. I mean, that's the guys on the team, you know, and, you know, I was walking like crazy. You know, they didn't want me to run yet. You know, I was out on the track walking, you know, for an hour and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff a week later. And, I mean, and shortly thereafter, I was able to get back on the bike. And a couple of my friends that I ride with all the time, they were like, man, if you were riding that good before and you weren't getting any blood, man, I don't want to ride with you anymore. Now you're getting a lot of blood. You're going to be in trouble, you know. So they was kind of joking about that, and but you know, I'm still on a lot of medication, blood thinners, and that kind of stuff. I'm getting near just past the year anniversary, so I go in for another checkup here shortly. But everything looks good, and you know, got to continue to do the right things as far as diet and exercise. Still got to work on that stress component a little bit, but hopefully, you know, because of modern science, you know, a little glitch can be overcome and can hopefully live a long and healthy life.
All right, and Coach, you know, I guess I'll kind of maybe wrap up on a kind of an interesting point. I always, you know, do a fairly cursory, quick read of stuff like, you know, the online coaches' bios and stuff before I sit and talk to somebody. And one of the things that kind of surprised me was that I saw that when you were first at Salisbury, you were coaching women's soccer for a little while as well as men's lacrosse. And, you know, you had some success with the women's soccer team at that. I guess, you know, are there parallels between the two that you see still line up? You know, is there certain aspects of coaching that's just coaching and, you know, with whether it's football or lacrosse or, you know, cricket, if you can figure out certain things, you can figure out how to instruct, how to motivate, how to do certain things like that?
Well, I believe, you know, that if you're a good coach and you're working hard and you're doing the right things and you set up the right culture and environment, I believe that you probably be most good coaches probably going to be pretty good at any sport that they coach, as long as they learn the X's and O's. And, you know, the soccer thing, it wasn't like I didn't have a soccer background. You know, I played soccer, was recruited to play soccer in college too, so I had a little bit of soccer background going into it, you know. Plus I had coached soccer at St. Lawrence there when I was, you know, the basketball coach. So I had a little bit of background. But a story a lot of people don't realize, you know, the first head sport that I coached at Salisbury wasn't women's soccer and it wasn't men's lacrosse. My first season here at Salisbury, you know, fall ball was just kind of finishing up. And, you know, October 15th is the magical day for basketball practice. You know, it's when it all starts. And, you know, and I coached basketball and played in college. And October 14th at about 5:30 that day, the athletic director, who was Bill Light at that time, comes into my office, you know, and the reason I'd come to Salisbury, because I don't have to coach one sport, says to me, hey, Jim, I need a huge favor. You know, this search thing has failed twice now, and we don't have a women's basketball coach to start practice tomorrow. I need you to be the women's basketball coach. So the first year I was here, I was the head women's basketball coach, you know, besides being the women's, you know, lacrosse coach. And then they found a coach that year. And then a few years later, like 94, 95, you know, we just started to get on a little roll with lacrosse, you know, with 94, that first championship. And Dr. Vianna came into my office, you know, I think in October once again, and said, hey, Jim, you know, because of Title IX and some other things, you know, we got to start a women's soccer team. And until we get some more staffing, we really need you to take the reins, you know, for a couple years. Well, I was fortunate to start it from scratch, and that was a pretty good experience, and I really enjoyed it. but thought it was only going to be a couple years, you know. Then 7 years later, I'm still coaching women's soccer, but, you know, we were fortunate at that time to lead the soccer team to a, well, I think it was like a 23-1-2 season and made it to the final eight, one game away from going to the final four. And the most successful women's soccer season ever, at, you know, at Salisbury before they were able to replace me and find another coach. So, done a few other things besides coach the cross at Salisbury, that's for sure.
And I guess, are there parallels or stark differences between coaching college-age men and college-age women? Or perhaps maybe it's the better way to phrase that, is it easier to coach college-age men or college-age women? Because I've heard different theories on this, and I'd like to know from a guy who's had success with both.
I wouldn't say it's easier. I would just say it's different. There's different issues in each thing. There's different challenges. But I firmly believe that my experience coaching women's soccer here has definitely made me a better men's lacrosse coach. From my experience with the young ladies and, you know, the journey that we went through together has made me a better overall coach and an appreciation of certain things. But again, you know, good players make good coaches. Recruiting them, developing them, you know, that's critical to success.
All right, well, Coach Berkman, thank you very much for giving me so much of your time today, and you know, good luck tonight in your what should be another great game in the history here, or the budding history of the Stevenson-Salisbury rivalry.
Thanks, Zach. Thanks for your time.